And our opening words are from the Reverend Gretchen Haley. What's going to happen? Will everything be okay? What can I do? In these days, we find ourselves too often stuck with these questions on repeat. What is going to happen? Will everything be okay? What can I do? We grasp at signs and articles of news and analysis, Facebook memes and forwarded emails, as if the new zodiac capable of forecasting all that life may yet bring our way, as if we could prepare, as if life ever made any promises of making sense or turning out the way we thought, as if we are not also actors in this still unfolding story. For this hour, we gather to surrender to the mystery, to release ourselves from the needing to know, the yearning to have it already figured out, and also the burden of believing we either have all the control or none. Here in our song and our silence, our stories and our sharing, we make space for new breath, a new feeling, a new possibility to take root. That is courage, forged in the fire of our coming together and felt in the spirit that comes alive in this act of faith, that we believe still that a new world is possible, that we are creating, ready here and now. So I offer this pastoral prayer, which was written by the Reverend Sunshine Jeremiah Wolfe, who is a transgender white man. And he offers this prayer for all of us for the Transgender Day of Remembrance, which is on the 20th. We remember those who have been murdered for being who they are, those who face violence on a daily basis, those who have lost loved ones, and those who worry for loved ones. May we come to a time when we cease to shame children around gender roles and expression, where we allow for freedom and exploration of identity and expression, and to a world that operates from love, especially when things are difficult and confusing. May all of us who live with the threat of violence find support, strength, community, hope, and safety. And now we will enter into 2 minutes of silence. Our reading this morning is from the Reverend Joseph Santos Lyons, Asian American Unitarian Universalist minister. Meeting another person of color in Unitarian Universalism for the first time was a spiritual experience for me. I knew they existed. They had to exist, as we are identified as a liberal and inclusive faith. As a child and a youth growing up at the West Hills Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Portland, Oregon, my understanding of the world as it related to racial ethnic cultures was stunted. The identities we claim, the names we call ourselves in racial, cultural, or ethnic terms were not easy to discuss at our fellowship or in my youth group experiences. I developed a mask about myself, one that hid a part of who I was and segregated me from the wisdom of the cultural communities I came from. This mask put me at risk of losing part of me, lying about or omitting a part of my historical personhood. Wholeness, unity, oneness of the universe are theological and political beliefs I had learned in Sunday worship and religious education. There was a contradiction that rubbed inside me, creating friction, frustration, and leading me to seek resolution in college. This month, our theme is memory. In southern Ghana, there is a word, Sankofa, which means to return and collect it. It means to look into the past to see the lessons it offers for the future. Today, we look back to the 1960s, to the story of Selma, and the controversy that tore the UUA apart afterwards, to learn what it can tell us about our journey to be an inclusive, multicultural faith. Our faith rests on two foundational pillars, the inherent worth and dignity of each person, and that we are part of the interconnected web of life. A multicultural faith is one that truly embraces those principles. It is a faith where any person, regardless of the color of their skin, their class, their gender, their sexual identity, feels whole, utterly included, and utterly themselves. It is a faith where no child must hide parts of themselves behind a mask. This is one of Unitarian Universalism's stories. On March 9, 1965, 2,500 African Americans and their white allies marched over the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. They stopped in front of a line of sheriff's deputies who waited with clubs, horses, and gas to stop the marchers. The courts had ordered that the marchers not march. So the protesters prayed instead. They sang the hymn we sang earlier this morning, "We Shall Overcome." Among them was the white UU minister, the Reverend James Reeb. He had flown to Selma the night before because on March 7th, almost 600 people, mostly black, attempted to cross the bridge to protest the police killing of a young black man, Jimmy Lee Jackson. Their purpose was to march from Selma to Montgomery to hold the governor accountable for this young man's death. This did not happen. Instead, the police attacked, beating protesters, charging the crowd with horses and gassing marchers. Many were severely injured. One of the organizers was beaten almost to death. That night, Martin Luther King Jr. made a national call for clergy and other people of faith to join him in Selma. Many Unitarian Universalists responded, including 45 UU ministers. Reeb, a 38-year-old father of four, decided to go. It was against his wife's wishes. This march, however, epitomized his life's work. He had left parish ministry to live in the poorest black neighborhood in Boston to do ministry with housing ministry with the people there. So when King called, Reeb was called to respond. He planned to fly home after the attempted march on March 9th, but King pleaded for people to stay, to figure out what would happen next. Reeb agreed. And that night, he found a couple of other UU ministers and headed for a dinner at Walker's Cafe, a black cafe, now overflowing with whites from the north, where they ate real southern fried chicken and mashed potatoes. After dinner, the three ministers started back to Brown Chapel, where all the organizing was happening. A group of white men shouted angrily at them, shouting racial slurs. Reeb and his colleagues ignored them. Then suddenly, one of the men swung a club, and Reeb crumpled to the street, his skull smashed. The others jumped Reeb's friends, kicking and punching them, and then they ran away into the night. Reeb was taken to a nearby clinic by ambulance, where a doctor determined he needed immediate care at the hospital in Birmingham. America was horrified by the attack on this young white minister. This included President Johnson, who sent yellow roses to Reeb's hospital room, and the presidential helicopter flew Reeb's wife and his father from Boston to Birmingham. Reeb died 2 days later. The country was outraged and grieving. 4 days later, President Johnson called a joint session of Congress and urged them to pass the Voting Rights Bill, one of the most important pieces of civil rights legislation. Martin Luther King, Jr. was invited to the speech, but did not attend it. Instead, he stayed in Selma and delivered the eulogy at Reeb's memorial. "What killed James Reeb?" he asked that day. He answered in part like this: "James Reeb was murdered by the indifference of every minister of the gospel who has remained silent behind the safe security of stained glass windows. He was murdered by the irrelevancy of a church that will stand amid social evil and serve as a taillight rather than a headlight, an echo rather than a voice." He ended his eulogy with hope, however: "We must work until men everywhere will respect the dignity and worth of human personality. We must work with all our hearts. We must work with determination for that great day." Unitarian Universalists were ready to do that work. After Reeb's death, the courts allowed the march from Selma to Montgomery. Over 3,000 marched, including 500 UUs and 25% of all UU ministers. UUs were at the forefront of organizing that final Selma march. It was a UU religious educator who mobilized the national movement, and they provided logistical support from blankets, staffing first aid stations, and transportation. Viola Liuza, a UU and a mother of five from Detroit, was transporting people when a car of white men drove beside her car and shot her, killing her instantly. Again, the country was outraged and grieved. Unitarian Universalists had stood up for racial justice. Two of our own were martyrs for the cause. UUs would be a headlight, not a taillight, and a voice, not an echo, in the struggle for racial justice. We Unitarian Universalists were poised for the future. It turns out that Selma, as horrifying and dangerous as it was easy. There was good guys, and there were bad guys, and all the Unitarian Universalists were the good guys. It was simple to figure out where we stood. What happened next was not. Unitarian Universalists ran right into systemic racism and white supremacist culture, something most of them did not understand at all. 2 years after Selma in 1967, inner-city riots ripped through this country. The UUA was determined not to be a taillight, but a headlight on issues of racial justice. So they called an emergency meeting in Boston to discern how to respond. Of the 135 attendees, 37 were black. It was an amazing moment for black participants. They came from churches where there was only one or two black families. They were now surrounded by other black UUs. It was like the spiritual experience that Joseph Stantis Lyons had when he first met another UU of color. The black empowerment movement was sweeping the U.S. The black people asked, "What does it mean to be people with our own power?" Inspired by this moment, the black UUs met in a black-only caucus to discuss what it meant to them to be black Unitarian Universalists and what they needed from their faith in this moment. They returned to the emergency meeting as the Black UU Caucus, and they had non-negotiable demands. The UU must establish a Black Affairs Council. The caucus would select the members, and the Black Affairs Council would receive $250,000 a year for 4 years that they could make in grants to the Black community. They would have complete control over the funding. Their demands were like dynamite. Values crashed into each other. The position of the Black Caucus, Black people have been disempowered for centuries and so need power to make the decisions that affect them. The response? Black-only decision-making is a form of segregation. UUs need to work together for racial justice. The Black Caucus response? When white and Black people make decisions together, it means white people decide. White people are used to deciding, and they take over the process. And by the way, 99% of UUs are white. The position of the Black Caucus. Our demands are not negotiable. We have talked, and we will settle for nothing less. The response? Non-negotiable demands are unacceptable in Unitarian Universalism. We are a democracy. The Black Caucus response? Sometimes we have to set aside democracy to repair oppression. Our democracy allowed this oppression. I want you to be clear. This was not a Black versus white argument. There were passionate Black and white people on both sides of this argument. For example, when these demands came to the UUA Board of Trustees, the only Black member said he would resign if the caucus demands were met. A white board member said that if the demands were not met, it would rather conclusively indicate that we have lost touch completely with the very ground of our faith as Unitarian Universalists. The battle lines were fundamentally about decision-making. Who decides and how did they decide? Was it fair for only Black people to make a decision? Was it fair to exclude white people from decision-making? Can democracy ever be set aside? What if the result of democracy is oppression? And that wasn't an academic question. In 1962, just 5 years before, the delegates at General Assembly had voted against a resolution that would have required UU congregations to remove white-only clauses from their bylaws. The argument was that the resolution violated congregational polity, and the UUA had no right to tell UU congregations what they would have in their bylaws. In that vote, democracy and congregational polity trumped oppression as the higher value for white Unitarian Universalists. The board blundered along. They did not meet the demands. They tried to sidestep the conflict by meeting what they thought were the Black Caucus's intentions, which missed that the whole entire argument was about who gets to decide, and you wouldn't wonder that the Black Caucus found this fairly patronizing. The Reverend John Wolfe, the white minister of All Souls Unitarian Church of Tulsa, understood. He said at the time, "I am forced to choose between two rights, democratic procedure or the redress of grievances of an oppressed minority." At the General Assembly in 1968, members voted to approve the Black UU Caucus demands. The Black Affairs Council was established, and they received the $250,000 in funding. The matter was not settled, though. The board decided General Assembly delegates must renew the funding each year. The tensions were really high when delegates met in Cleveland in 1969. After a procedural vote, which the Black Caucus and their white allies lost, almost all of the 200 to 300 Black delegates walked out. Jack Mendelson, white minister at Arlington Street Church in Boston, left to find them. I found them at a room at the Statler. They were saying goodbye to one another. They were in tears. They were broken. They were going home because no one had left with them. Mendelson went back to the assembly with a plan to repair relationships. When he got off the podium, another white minister spit in his face. When people walk out of business meetings en masse and ministers spit in each other's faces, that's about as bad as it can get. The conflict trudged on. The delegates in Cleveland did vote for another year of funding. However, in another tragic story, not this tragic story, the UU was broke. So the board cut back the Black Affairs Council budget substantially, and the next year, GA delegates voted not to fund the council anymore. Organizational survival beat out racial justice. Black UUs walked away from Unitarian Universalism, including a very young Bill Sinkford, who later became a UU minister, president of the UUA, and is now minister at First Church here in Portland. UU efforts toward racial justice lay in shambles. There are no good guys and there are no bad guys in this story. It is filled with passionate people who could not agree on how to balance conflicting values and methods to meet the same goals. We had no governance structures or theology to help us know how to share power within a U.S. white culture which had been created to maintain white power and control. People who wanted racial justice and congregational polity and democracy did not know how to negotiate that. Instead, people took sides with such a passion that friendships ended and hearts were broken. Sankofa, return and collect it. Unitarian Universalists have learned a lot in the last 50 years. We have learned that when people have been historically oppressed, they must lead their own movement. They must lead and decide, or the oppression is not ended. We have learned a lot about white privilege. We have learned the ways racism twists and changes from Jim Crow to mass incarceration and into other forms that are hard to see at first. We have also continued to be active, taking national stands for racial justice. UU ministers and lay people showed up in Ferguson after the death of Michael Brown. We showed up again at Standing Rock after leaders there called for clergy to support the protesters. 50 of the 500 ministers were UUs. UU lay people and ministers were in Charlottesville, including the UUA president, Susan Frederick Gray, who describes the terror of standing face-to-face with gun-toting white supremacists while the police stayed far away. Repeatedly, UUs show up at the U.S.-Mexican border to witness, to learn, and to protest the ways those who seek asylum or flee from poverty are treated inhumanely. UUs walk into the deserts with water and offer kindness and aid to those in need. Still, our congregations are mostly white, and so are most of our leaders. However, compelled by our faith and its dream of a compassionate world where all can be whole, people of color join our congregations and become ministers and religious educators. It is a faith that calls for all kinds of people, with a vision of beloved community that our world needs so desperately. We desperately need Unitarian Universalism and our idea, our commitment that every person has inherent worth and dignity, and that we are part of a human web and a natural web that supports us all. It is a vision that speaks to all people, regardless of their skin color or where they live or poverty or their educational status or their gender identity or sexual identity. Still, it's true, though, in many congregations, people of color have to wait, as did Joseph Santos Lyons, who was so beloved here, until General Assembly to meet other UUs who look like them. White culture can be insidious in the way that works through our attitudes, our ideas of what is normal, and institutions that keep white people in power. The UUA discovered this again in the spring of 2017, not very long ago, where crisis over race once hit again. And here's what you have to know to understand it. It's hard. It's really hard to be a religious professional of color in Unitarian Universalism. They have a difficult time getting hired. While serving congregants and other UUs often question their qualifications, suggest that they were hired as tokens, challenge their authority, make culturally uninformed comments, or even use racial slurs. And the UUA has offered very little support to help those professionals, and itself has a pattern of hiring white professionals rather than people of color or other people into leadership positions. So in the winter of 2017, the UUA began the process to hire a regional director to oversee congregational staff. And congregational staff are people such as Candy Rogers, who visited us last month. All four of the other regional directors, we have just five, were white ministers. And the person who was retiring had also been a white minister. Then the UUA announced it would hire another white minister. A Latina UU religious professional, not a minister, came forward and said that she had been told she was a finalist and that she was qualified, but that she had not been a good fit. So you don't have to have much anti-racism and anti-oppression training to know that the word fit in hiring are words that are used to describe someone everyone in the workplace is comfortable with. And it turns out, usually, almost always, someone who is just like the people who they are hiring. So it's a lack of diversity plan. And yes, at that time, the UUA leadership was 86% white. Things blew up. The fight was bitter, and it was ugly. I don't know if anyone spit in anyone's face, but after reading Facebook comments during that time, I would not be surprised. 2 months later, after the crisis had settled a bit, the president of the UUA had resigned, as had two other top people at the UUA, both white men, male ministers, and the executive director of the UU Ministers Association, also a white male minister. As it happened in the empowerment controversy, friendships, collegial relationships, and careers were destroyed. Last April, a year later, the Commission on Institutional Change, a group of people charged by the UUA board to look deeply at the UUA and make changes around anti-racism, anti-oppression practices, and increasing multiculturalism, wrote a report on what happened. SANCOFA, return and collect it. What they asked in their report is, can we live our UU foundational values when we center white culture values and practice in our faith? Because as before during the empowerment controversy, The questions were all about what we value and how we rank what we value. But these questions were even trickier than the first ones. They were not only about who makes decisions, and it was certainly about that as well, but also about how do we decide who is best qualified for a job? Is it someone we've known a long time and trust? Someone we really know can get the job done the way we think the job should be done? Should we go out and ask all those people to apply? Should it be someone who has a lot of supervisory experience, who is seen as a leader by many, or someone who knows Latinx culture? Someone the white professionals and UU congregationals will trust as authoritative because they have many degrees and a long line of experience? Or someone religious educators and professionals of color will know, understand their experiences, and can go to and talk to and learn how to be religious educators and professionals of color in our faith? Are degrees more important than lived experience? In a culture where science demonstrates repeatedly that racial bias exists in almost all of us, is it okay for white progressive liberals to say they are colorblind and don't need support of systems and criteria to hire fairly? Sankofa, return and collect it. UUs have to, for sure, continue to stand up in the public square against racial injustice. We have to fight for laws of indiscrimination practices and voter suppression. These are crucial issues, and we are very good at standing up in the public square. However, if we want to build a multicultural faith where no one has to put on the mask and hide parts of who they are, where every person can experience oneness and wholeness to create the beloved community that we truly dream of, we have to do more than that. We have to do something harder. We have to look deeply at what seems right to the core of our very beings, and ask, is it right because it's what my culture taught me was right? Or is it right because it builds a multicultural faith where every person can flourish? And maybe sometimes that means making a decision that feels wrong to us in some way. It's something where there has to be really hard and difficult conversations, and where there will absolutely be conflict, because those are hard things to figure out. And we are really lucky here at this congregation, because we have a racial justice team that is helping lead our congregation into that journey. Every third Sunday, that's today, we are in the soup together conversations. They are conversations about what it means to be white, what white privilege is, how do those values play out in our hearts and minds and in the way we are with one another and with others who are different from ourselves. And I really hope that you will choose to spend some of your time joining them. We really need each other to do this. This is not work that a person can do on their own, because you start talking in circles and you kind of convince yourself you're right. You need somebody else to stand out beside you and say, hey, did you think about this other thing? And it is often also so difficult and painful to discover that what you believe to be the right way of doing things doesn't really build the beloved community that we most want. We need each other desperately in this. Martin Luther King Jr. said at James Reed's memorial that we must work with all our hearts. Yes, we must do this work with our hearts. And I know this about this congregation. You are a big-hearted, loving people, and you can do this. It's uncomfortable. It's challenging. It's hard. There's going to be conflict, and we hate that. But we have hearts that can hold this. And I have no doubts in you. And may that be so.